Pack, session number 30285.
John Dixon, Reel 15.
Where are we now?
So you're still at Bomber Command headquarters, aren't you?
I mentioned the kind of cushion there. I had a low-level bomb in there as a training place, didn't I? I did include that. I was going to say that was quite interesting during my dialing cushion period, because I did manage to do quite a few trips in the various aircraft, the Meteors, which we had there, the Canberras, the Javelins, Chipmunk. I managed to get in some hours of flying.
You mentioned some of the flights at RAF Whiting, haven't you?
Oh, Whiting, that's right. That's down there to Lucca, Carlton, and Witten, Ballycally. Yeah. Yes, so... And that's at Bomber Command.
So when did you arrive? When did you arrive there? When was that?
30th of the 6th. I did my first.
But you'd arrived in 63, haven't you?
Yeah, that's right. This would be later on doing a staff visit, actually. Yes. I remember that.
So were there any other duties while you were at headquarters, Bomber Command?
No, I didn't. I don't recall having any secondary duties, as we call them. It was interesting where we had our intelligence officers, really, because they're, of course, absolutely steeped in the history of Bomber Command in the Second World War. We had to go underground to get down into our work areas, and the intelligence section was in behind another steel combination type door. So not only did you have to burrow down into the earth like a blinking worm, you had to then find your way into the intelligence section through another steel permanently locked door. So all in all, most of the time on duty, we were all underground in exactly the same areas that the Second World War bomber campaigns had been run from. I mean, nothing has really changed. There's the corridors, there's the doors, there's the operations room with squadron strength and air order of battle, and all that, all still there, brought up to date, of course, I think, but nothing had been changed. But I don't recall it. I had any secondary duties there. We were just left there. We had a group captain who headed up the intelligence team there.
And with the intelligence team, were you all subdivided into different areas and specialisms?
Yes. We had a navigator who looked after navigational problems. We had a signaller. What was he? Yes, he was a signal. Yes, and he looked after things like radios and radars and things like that. They had a squadron leader over him who looked after the whole of that particular area of intelligence. And then there was the side that I was employed on. We came directly under the group captain, and there was a squadron leader and myself. And we looked after other things like that might be involved, miscellaneous things. I had my specialist to look after the aircraft up in the northeast things, and that's how we ran. And we had a lecture room down there where we could bring in visiting staff and parliamentary people and give them an up-to-date briefing on our responsibility and what was going on. So I don't recall doing any secondary duties there at all.
And how long was that posting for?
I stayed there until 1965. And then this time I just... Yes, and this time it was an overseas post to Aden. And they switched me again. This time, I became the the command cryptographic and center officer in charge of that, which meant primarily I was responsible for seeing that the appropriate ciphers and codes were used throughout the Middle East and Africa, and to see that they had the appropriate codes at the appropriate times. And so it was I became the center of a rather large network of distribution and positioning for various exercises, cryptographic code material and codes.
Was this at the time when it was being, all the activity on the headquarters were being centred on Aden? That was going to be considered to be the sort of base for the Middle East at that point?
Yes, you're quite right, of course. The headquarters of the Middle East had been in Cyprus, and it was moved down to Aden. And I think, I'm pretty sure of it actually, but Aden had been a bit of a backwater. It was being not even necessarily used by people going down to Africa, because they could come across Egypt and so on in those days. And it was a pretty tatty place to be. I don't think there was any great queue for anybody to go to Aden that I can recall. In fact, they told me that I was the third officer that they'd had to sort out to go to Aden, because the previous two appointees couldn't make it for various reasons.
Did you take your family?
Yes, I was coming around to that. We had two systems there for officers. One was whether you were posted to an accompanied post, which allowed you to bring your family out, or unaccompanied, which meant that you would be doing a year there unaccompanied from your wife and family. And that caused a lot of bitterness. In fact, I had a flying officer who was part of my staff, and he was on an unaccompanied tour. And he was a very unhappy young officer, understandably. He'd gone out there and realized he wouldn't see his wife for a year. Other people who were in unaccompanied posts arranged for their wives to come and join them privately. But of course that meant that if they were there privately, they weren't entitled to any allowances or subsistence, and that caused quite a bit of upset amongst a lot of people. That was that aspect of it, which wasn't very pleasant for people. But I waited, I think it was 3 months, and then my family came and joined me, and my younger son and my daughter, they came out.
And what was the situation like in Aden when you arrived?
It was quite unpleasant, really. Apart, there's a number of things there, of course. It had been a backwater, there's no doubt about that. And now, when I arrived there, the headquarters had moved down to it, and they were building places for accommodation and so on. And the main street there was Mala. And on one side, then there were just block after block after block of flats for the officers and the airmen to live. But on the security side, because of the guerrilla-type fighting that was going on there, we were limited heavily on any aspect of social entertainment. For instance, I never attended a single social function in the officers' mess at Steamer Point, which was where my headquarters were, during the period I was there. We were limited to at home to having, I think it was 12 people at any one function. And also, they weren't allowed to be out on the streets after midnight. So there were all these security restrictions. And in addition, that produced problems because they had a tendency, these Arabs, to a cowardly lot, they were. They would throw grenades at various places where they could do it without getting caught, you know, over walls and things like that. In fact, they threw one while I was standing in the queue at the outdoor cinema with my wife when somebody shouted, "Grenade," and my wife very hurriedly slid underneath all the feet to get in. The grenade itself rolled underneath a vehicle and didn't explode. So it might have caused quite a bit of trouble with the old people in the queues there waiting to go in. So there was that type of sneaky type fighting going on. But the place was heavily patrolled by the army. And indeed, they set up a heavy machine gun post above our flat on the roof, which overlooked the Arab area of Aden behind Mama. So there was all these problems, and there were people being killed. In fact, in the mess at Steamer Point, when I was there was. They had a head boy there, of course, looking after the mess, and there was an explosion in the morning, and they found he'd blown himself up. He'd been setting a bomb underneath the one of the dining room tables to catch us at breakfast, but he blew himself up in the process. So there were these various type of things going on. A friend of mine was. His wife was killed there when his boy put an explosive in a cupboard and it blew up when he was having a party and killed one or two people. On the major side, of course, there were various activities going on up at the crater where Mad Mick was doing his tricks up there. And on one night after some fighting, the flat I was in was on the corner of a road coming off Marla, which led into the coal store. And they used to put the bodies in there. And I noticed one night as I stood on the balcony that there was a lorry coming round, which stopped to turn round, and they had bodies on the back of the lorry under the drape. So I knew where they were off to. The fighting caused a lot of inconvenience. We had to come back after we'd finished our duty in the morning, and then we would take up guarding all the flats. I'd strap on a 38, and then we would have to share the responsibilities of guarding the flat by the occupants. And so we'd do that and then hand over to another officer, and he'd come and take over the job.
How would you get between Steamer Point and your flat? Kind of transport?
By car. But we had our own personal cars, yeah. But we didn't use buses. The only people that used buses were the children going to school, and we had to provide guards for the children as well to see that they weren't disturbed going to school.
How worrying for you was it having your family in that environment? How worrying was it for you having your family in that environment?
It seemed to go all right, but it was a strange existence to have a family there. It was very strange. Most of the wives and the teenage children and so on seemed to be employed in some form of government job. I came to the conclusion, I mean, that involved everything from being a clerk to the padre to doing whatever other jobs. And I think what they were really doing there, and I'm sure of it now, was to compensate the people for being there, the wives and families, by giving them jobs to do and keep it, otherwise they would couldn't do anything, and there was nowhere to go out of Aden without some risk, and they would have just been sat around or gathering together, these ladies and their children. So I have a feeling that they created a lot of the jobs there, and to give them some pocket money. And my daughter, in fact, who had just left boarding school before we came out there, I found she was in the office next to mine, up at Steamer Point. I said, "What in the world are you doing there?" And she said, "I'm in the mapping department of the army." I said, and it meant that with no social life in the mess, and we couldn't walk, wasn't advisable to walk into any of the Arab areas or anything like that. You were very, very restricted in what you could do. And Steamer Point had a beach there, which was for officers, in essence. And most families would go there daily and do a bit of swimming and lying about in the sun. That was generally it.
What about shopping and that sort of thing for food? How was that conducted?
Shopping wasn't too bad. The shopping itself, of course, was appalling by the nature of things. There's never anything fresh there. It was all coming from the ice stores, the shops where you could buy your butter and bits and pieces. But we didn't tend to eat very much at home because of that. And to give us a break, they set up a rest centre in Mombasa, and so we could apply to go down and take our families to Mombasa, to the rest centre, and have a couple of lovely weeks on the beaches in Kenya, which we did, and that was very pleasant. The other thing we were doing on the duty side was we would be put on a roster from time, and from time to time we'd have to undertake duties involving taking out armed airmen in a jeep, and we were responsible, the RAF, for the security and patrolling of a particular area of Aden. I think that was to ease the burden on the army. And that meant that we would go out armed at night. I'd have a machine gun, and the troops would have their rifles and things. And we'd go up and down in the back streets, wherever we were patrolling, keeping an eye on things and seeing that things were peaceful and quiet. Not too far into the Arab areas, of course, but generally that was another task that we had to do to maintain security there.
Would you deviate your route occasionally? You wouldn't take the same route every time?
No. And the roads were all blocked. The main roads were all blocked off. You couldn't go far before you'd be halted by barricades of some sort. Couldn't get up to steamer. And that's why I'm always puzzled how the Americans, when the Marines went into the Lebanon, set up their headquarters and yet allowed a vehicle with a bomb to explode outside the front door. And that, as you know, killed a couple of hundred or so, injured Marines, and they withdrew from there. Well, you couldn't do that in Aden. The roads were appropriately barricaded, and there's no way you could get a vehicle up there. So we never had anything like that take place. So the time came when, of course, we were going to abandon Aden, and it coincided more or less with my completion of my tour there.
So do you know 65 to 67?
Yes.
Did things get progressively worse during that period?
Yes. It's a question of morale, isn't it? A lot of people were unhappy being there anyway. And then things did get worse as it became obvious that we were going to retreat from there and hand it over. And we'd already had... the United Nations sent somebody there as well to have a look around, and he said some adverse comments about what we were doing there and so on and so on. So I don't think morale was terribly high, and that meant that as we got nearer, I think we left £25 million worth of equipment behind us, couldn't get it out. Although for the first time the services, in my experience, became very generous to us. They said, if you've got any room in your cases when you're going home, you are allowed to take with you, if you like, one or two of the hearth mats that are on the floor in your flat, or one or two items from your kitchen, like the pepper pots and things like that, if you've got the room for them.
How did you actually leave? Did you fly out?
Yes, we flew out. And whereas the civilians who were there came home, of course, on one of the cruise liners, an East African run, and would do various tricks, like take their car with them and get off in Europe and drive home. Or alternatively, go bring their families and so on back to them. So I think the civilians did as well as could be expected from there. I think they were looked after much more generously, of course, than the armed forces. We used to be able to go aboard the ships. Like Canberra came in, and you could go aboard the Canberra and have a drink of British beer and a chat with the crew and so on. But that was stopped on security grounds, so we couldn't do that eventually. And then it was time to come back, and there was some sort of a strange hiccup going on, because the weeks were going by and my tour was rapidly coming to an end, and I hadn't been told where I was going, and I found this a bit perplexing. In fact, it got so perplexing that there was a team from the ministry, I think, yes, headed up by a group captain who was presumably involved in sorting out the problems of postings and all that sort of thing, and he called me for an interview, and he said, you haven't been told where you're going. And I said, no, I haven't, and I'm due to finish my tour here in a few weeks. And he said, well, we'll try and sort that out. And strange enough, he mentioned about my spell in Bridgnorth, which was very interesting. I think he did ask me, did anything go wrong there? So he said, well, we'll fix up the posting for you and get that sorted out. And I said, right. And then the posting came through, and that came as a huge shock, because I was posted for Leighton Buzzard. And Leighton Buzzard was a small, compact RAF base which was responsible for all communications worldwide with the RAF. It also had, of course, the usual cryptographic centre, very small, really. And the transmitters were stationed some miles away from the state, but it was administered from Stanbridge, and that I was terribly, terribly unhappy about.
What was the reason for that? Why were you so unhappy?
Well, it didn't seem to me to be an appropriate job for an officer of my experience, for all the various type of jobs I'd had, from staff appointments down to other type work. I wanted a full-time job which was going to give me satisfaction, and clearly a job of that nature was going to be a nothingness, and that's what it turned out to be. And I had a personal objection, in any case, to the structure of the cryptographic world and the signals world. The signal side followed a World War II practice, I think, of using non-signals personnel branch for running the cryptographic cells in Empire. I always thought that they ought to be running the show themselves. You know, it's located in their communication centres and all that sort of thing. And I thought, I didn't like that, and I didn't want to be involved in it. I mean, I was a grown technical signals man. That's not my role. And so I was unhappy about that. And it worked out when we got to Leighton Buzzard and I got into my job. I realised it was a non-job for an officer of my experience. And I wondered, what that was supposed to mean. And so I had a visit from the headquarters, from the wing commander, and I talked with him about various things, and I said, I don't think there's a post here for an officer. There's not enough work or responsibility. And I said, not only that, but across the road there's a signals man. It's part of the signals empire, this, and that there's the chap who should be running this as a part-time job. He's got his appropriate NCOs, you know, and it makes sense. And so he agreed with my views, and eventually I got a posting from him.
So how long had you done that job there?
I came back in 67, and I was there until the autumn of 68. And as I told you about it being a non-job, that they passed on to me. I became the mess secretary, which meant I had to control the accounts and all the rest of the organisation in the mess, of which we had a lot of officers who were on the camp who worked in the Ministry of Defence and came at their houses, quarters at Stanbridge. And then on top of that, they told me that I was now to become the nuclear biological and chemical warfare officer on the station. And I said, well, I don't know anything about that. And they said, yes, but we're going to send you on a course. I said, course? What course? Yes, it's 3 weeks down there at Wiltshire near Salisbury. And that's what they did. They sent me on a 3 weeks course to learn about nuclear and biological chemical warfare. And then when I got back, I found that I had the responsibility for detailing all the staff on the station to ensure that they were adequately trained in aspects of nuclear, biological and chemical warfare. And the infantry that they tried to pass over to me was enormous. It was in a big hut, and it was full of equipment which was on infantry. And I said, what am I supposed to do with it? They said, well, you've got to check it. I said, what? And they said, yes, because you're going to have to sign for it on an infantry. And I said, oh my God. So those were the time-consuming elements of my alleged job. But anyway, the next posting that I got was exactly what I wanted, and put me back into the empire that I'd really been working in. And that was the intelligence, of course. But this time, I was sent to Headquarters Air Support Command, who were based at Dar Afap in Wiltshire. And again, I joined the intelligence staff there. And I had two squadron leaders and myself. And that became a very interesting job for me. Time to time doing staff visits to stations.